You are listening to Cuck Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. This is Friday, April the 5th, 2024. And no, my friends, you have not gone crazy. It is, in fact, JJ Sefton here, along with CBD, and we have a very special guest with us that we'll introduce in a moment. But just first, let me just say that from the bottom of my heart, I am absolutely touched by the incredible outpouring of prayers and love and all the great messages from everybody in light of my recent news about my medical situation. So with that said, thank you. God bless you all. And we've scheduled our guest for a long time, and I just didn't want to disappoint by not being on and talking to him. So without further ado, it's CBD and our very special guest, who has sort of been our unofficial science reporter and reporter of politics in general on occasion and more recently, the great Robert Zimmerman. So CBD and Robert Zimmerman, welcome to the podcast.
Great Robert Zimmerman, my God, I've never been told, no one's ever referred to me that before. Thank you, great day. I appreciate that. I'm glad to be here though. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it very much.
You're so welcome. CBD, are you there? I think we may have lost CBD unless he
I'm here. I'm trying not to step on everybody. So before we go get into the politics, we have a very, very interesting segment planned on Robert's series on what's going to happen in November. I would like to point out a sort of a science-y aspect of it. And that I had a couple of hours. I just experienced my first earthquake on the East Coast. It was a 4.8 magnitude earthquake that was centered about 50 miles southwest of me. About a 10-second rumble. It felt like a heavy truck going past, or maybe a blast of a nice nor'easter storm. But it was very, very interesting. It ended too quickly for me to be concerned. But apparently everybody on the East Coast is freaking out because, oh my God, it was an earthquake. And the reason I can say this so easily is because I lived on the West Coast. I lived in the Bay Area for about 20 years. So I am familiar with what earthquakes feel like. Anyway, let's move on.
Yes, indeed. So and I'm going to call him Bob because that's what, you have written many, many books, both in terms of science and a number of things in terms of politics. But we're going to talk about a recent series you had on your wonderful blog, which everybody should be following. It's called BehindTheBlack.com. And it's all about your predictions for the upcoming election. Let's not even call it election day anymore because it's election season, and what the meshugas and shenanigans and outright perhaps terrorism that the Democrat left is going to do to prevent what seems like an inevitable win for Donald Trump. And if not a landslide, then certainly a clear victory, and what that portends.
JJ, one of the reasons I write is to keep a sane brain, to keep myself sane. And I would probably bury my head in a tub of water if I didn't write, because thinking about this stuff and not getting it out gets very depressing. So writing is the only way I can keep my brain sane. And so that's one of the reasons I do the website. And most of the websites about space and astronomy and commercial space and things like SpaceX and planetary exploration on Mars and elsewhere. Because that's what I've been, I'm a science journalist and space historian now for 30 years. Oh my God, 30 years. But I've always felt it very important to include the component of politics in any of my histories about space, because space has always been closely tied to the politics of its time. The whole space race in the 60s was tied very closely to the Cold War. You can't write about it without talking about that. And in fact, very few space histories have done that. I found myself to be an exception to the rule, not the rule. And it's a shame. Historians are missing, not doing their job. So because I'm interested in the politics, the undercurrent of politics, to give a greater context to space history, I research and learn quite a bit about that kind of stuff. And then, as I say, to keep myself sane, I write a column every day, most days, I'd say 90% of the time. Sometimes I just get burned out, but pretty much every day about something going on. After 2020, after Biden took power, I made that column today's Blacklisted American because there were so many examples of that. I figured you could do a column a day. And for almost 3 years, I was doing five Blacklisted columns a week without stopping. Finally, after almost 3 years, two and a half years, I'm sorry, I started to spread it out to other things because not that there's less blacklisting going on, but we've gotten a lot of pushback going on from people suing and from state governments responding. So I figured let's talk a little bit of other things. And then I started to widen it out again to write about the kind of stuff I would normally write about. And so that's where this part, three-part column came from. My brain was stewing over the fact lot of dishonesty to go on from the Democrats with this coming election. And it's all based upon what they did in the past. And what really inspired it was an essay I saw. Where was it? It was, gosh, it was, who did it? I want to give credit where credit is due. It was a guy who wrote this Substack column, I think, in which he talked about the debt Republicans retiring from the House of Representatives. And it looked like these were all never Trumpers, and they were all doing it in a way to actually give the House back to the Democrats. And this guy was very negative, that had a very pessimistic view. He said, it looks to me like Democrats will control the Congress when the election occurs, and they're going to use that power to make Trump illegitimate candidate, because based on the Supreme Court decision. So anyway, so I saw that and I said, well, you know, that's only one thing, and that might not be the only thing they do, and it might not even be the most likely thing they do, because to take any action like that before the election could actually cost some moderate Democrats, if there is such a thing, in certain close districts could lose the vote if they tried to kick Trump out. So I don't think anything will go on before the election in that matter, but there are going to be a lot of other things going on. And so I had to do literally three different columns. I talked about that one in the first column, because if they are controlling the House and Senate come November and December, they could use that to invalidate any election results if they should go against them. And they want to try to establish some precedents for doing so. So I talked about lawfare. This is what's been going on with Trump, all these bogus prosecutions, persecutions of people in Georgia and New York State, intending to create a legal a framework for justifying making him an illegitimate candidate. That those tie in, and then you get their typical brown-shirted Antifa BLM rioters. They're going to be there, and if you thought 2020 was violent, I think we're underestimating what's going to come. I mean, we've got to face this. They've already shown us what they're willing to do in the last 6 months. Pro-Hamas demonstrations where they are violent, they are vicious, where they block roads, where they threaten people physically. And I think this is only going to get worse, especially if Trump does manage to win the election despite the vote tampering that's going to go on. And that's another point I've discussed at length that. You know, Trump likes to talk about that the election was stolen from him. And I don't like to say that because I don't know if the election was stolen or not. But what I do know is that there was enormous allegations, legitimate allegations of voter fraud, election fraud, and vote tampering in multiple states in 2020. It's not a question of whether Trump was election was stolen, maybe, but the fact is there was solid legitimate allegations of voter tampering. And that needed to be looked into at length. And it hasn't been to the extent it should have been, partly because the Democrats and their minions in the press, their operatives in the press, have decided that anyone who even suggests you look into the allegations is an insurrectionist and a traitor. And they've They've gone after numerous Trump lawyers for raising legitimate legal issues on this matter, and they've gotten several disbarred on that matter. So they're doing lawfare, and what they've done is tried to create a situation where election fraud can continue to go on. And finally, and then we have, of course, backroom deals. Will Biden even be the candidate? And this is the Torticelli approach. I talk about Robert Torticelli, who is the Democratic senator in New Jersey. CBD will know who I'm talking about, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
Yes, he in 2002, he was the incumbent. He was running. He suddenly got charged with corruption, federal corruption charges. He was losing. And so the Democrats, ignoring the actual laws about who you can put on a ballot, they were able to switch the candidate to Frank Lautenberg, who retired and was 78 years old, and you had to wheel him in on a stretcher to get him anywhere. But they were able to switch candidates in the last minute, even though that didn't follow the law in New Jersey. But they did it. And so this could very well happen in this election because Biden is so bad a candidate, and the Democrats recognize how bad a candidate is. Is. And so we might see that happen now.
So, you know, that's actually that's in the news in the conservative blogosphere, that what are the Democrats going to do to get rid of Joe Biden? But I think that they are going to keep Joe Biden. And the reason is that he is a perfect puppet for Barack Obama and Obama's minions, who are obviously running this administration. And I think that Barack Obama wants Biden to win, and I think that it will give him four more years. It will be his fourth term. And I really don't see how the Democrats can buck Biden and his power broker, Obama.
In this sense, I agree with you. Is that JJ?
Yeah. I was just going to say a couple of things. To your point, Bob, as you know, as everybody knows, is that first of all, you know, number one, you know, you're preaching to the choir and singing from my hymnal as far as writing and doing what I do every day to sort of keep sane. And it's kind of ironic that what I try to do to keep sane may very well be the cause of my of the condition I find myself in, neurologically speaking. But in any case, I am of the belief that at a minimum, if the election wasn't stolen, that there was so much hinkiness and so much fraud and so much of the institutional corruption of changing the laws at the last minute, that you cannot say that beyond a reasonable doubt there is suspicion that at the very minimum you have to call it into question. And the fact that anybody who calls it into question, as you point out so correctly, is labeled as an insurrectionist, a terrorist, a vote denier, and a crazy and a crackpot, and basically worse than Hitler, so to speak. We also had the fact that we had the 44,000 hours of videotape on January 6th, which everybody refused to release. I mean, they didn't release it until I believe it was maybe Kevin McCarthy did as one of his things. And I'm saying, if this thing wasn't stolen, if this was an insurrection, as you say it was, then show us. Then you should not be afraid to show and point us to the evidence that proves us wrong, that will shut us up once and for all and make us look like idiots. But instead of doing that, they've done just the opposite, which makes them look, you know, at least in the eyes of any reasonable person who doesn't, you know, pay attention to the media, it makes them look like they're covering something up. And so, you know, there we have it. As far as this election with Biden, I almost want to think that they want Trump to win so that they can sort of pretend that, you see, the elections are legitimate. And then, of course, the bureaucracy will do everything like it did last time to totally sabotage his administration at every turn.
Let me insert some thoughts here, because my third part, this speaks directly to the third part of my three-part essay, which is what happens if Trump actually does win? Like you say, it's possible they're not going to, that the tampering can't possibly overcome the vote totals. And so they will make a decision to let Trump win. But that doesn't mean the Democratic Party will allow Trump to take office. As I say, there are going to be riots. If you think before the election, there are going to be riots and violence, there's going to be a lot worse after the election. You can see hints of that by how they're responding to the Biden administration's so far support of Israel against Hamas in Gaza. The demonstrations and the protests have been sometimes violent and vicious. And this is only a hint of what will happen if they don't get their way in an election. So you're going to see that. But you'll also see endless legal maneuvers. So they get Trump to win. Trump wins, but then they're going to do the lawfare against him, maybe in Congress, to prevent him from being certified as the president. But they will also be questioning vote totals. Suddenly, it'll be okay to discuss allegations of voter fraud. And they will do that endlessly. This won't end. And then I talked about something that people don't want to talk about or won't want to deal with, but you've got to deal with this stuff if you want to be prepared. And that's the question of assassination. And I really think, and you've mentioned this, JJ, in your column periodically, and I think we have to talk about it. And the Republicans had better face it, and Trump had better face it, because if he doesn't, he's going to find himself dead. There's a good chance of that, because from the period of November to January, it's going to be very dangerous for Republicans, because Trump has made it very clear when he released his in October of 20, his Schedule F executive order, which would have allowed him to fire many civil servants now at will, that would allow him to do that at will, which now he can't, could not do. They know that's coming. They also know that Trump recognizes clearly that the FBI, CIA, ETF, the Justice Department are weaponized for the Democratic Party. So he's going to have to move aggressively to clean house there. And he's going to have to move fast, because he should demand their resignation from day one. But that can't happen until January. So for November, December, and into January, these people will still be in place and have power. And these intelligence agencies have demonstrated that they are weaponized as the KGB arm of the Democratic Party, and they know their power will be very seriously threatened, and they know that some of them could very well be prosecuted for breaking laws. So they're not going to want this. They're going to be very willing to do some very bad things, I think, and they're going to have the support of the bureaucracy because of that Schedule F threat, because a lot of the bureaucracy stymied Trump's first term. They're very Democratic, very Democratic. And so they're going to be hand in glove with this. And then we get to secession. This is discussed about. I don't really think this is a very likely possibility, but it should be talked about once again. The Democratic strongholds in California, New York, Massachusetts, Oregon, and Washington, and in Chicago region, they might not accept a Trump victory if he should be certified. And you could have situations where we're facing another civil war. And where I get cloudy here is that when the civil war occurred in the 1860s, remember, I'm a historian first and foremost, so I've read a great deal about this from original sources to the actual many histories. What made the civil war occur in 1860 made it clearly an aggressive war was that it was being fought over the issue of slavery, which had a strong moral component, clear moral component. So it made it very easy for Northerners to unify and fight back when the South wanted to secede, because they couldn't tolerate a slave country next door to them. They couldn't allow such a thing to happen. But we do not have that clear moral situation right now. And so, based on my own reading of the American public, Americans, too many Americans, and this could be a majority, not only do not know our glorious history, but have been taught that we're an evil country that caused slavery. There's actually been a poll that young people think slavery was invented in the United States. They're so badly educated. And so we don't have a strong moral nation anymore that wants to defend this country. And so what would happen if these states seceded? I just don't know. It's very cloudy, and I just have no idea.
Well, the topic of secession is interesting, because let's face it, the states that will secede are Texas, Florida, perhaps one of the mountain states.
I'm sorry, JJ, let me just interrupt. You're taking it from the Republican side, who would want to secede from the Union. I was taking it from the Democratic side, who would want to secede from America if Trump wins. So it's interesting. I want to hear your point of view, but it's the opposite side. And what conservatives, Republican states, are seceding.
Yeah, so I see zero drive on the part of the Democrat junta to foment rebellion, which is essentially what it would be, and secede. And none of the blue states have any interest in secession, because there's no advantage to them. They lose the ability to suckle on the federal teat, and they lose much of the glory that is American exceptionalism. That is our industrial base, you know, as faded as it is, our agricultural base as tremendous as it is, and our technological base, which is still pretty damned important. They will lose that because the manufacturing portion is primarily in the red states. I don't see it. And I understand your point, and it makes logical sense. But I think the emotion of it overwhelms whatever logical sense they might have that it is time to secede from a resurgent MAGA country.
Right. I see. To CBD's point, and I do kind of agree with him on that, is that I don't look at it in terms of like the old Civil War of North versus South of separating into a two-state solution. We have a situation where the Democrats and the American left, they don't want us to live. They don't want us to see. They don't want any kind of divorce, amicable or otherwise, where we get to exist. They want to conquer us, lock, stock, and barrel, the same as the Islamists want to conquer Israel and the rest of the world, really, in the long run. So that's really what we're kind of up against. And unfortunately, D.C., as you say, Bob, it's the institutions, the bureaucracy, the Department of Defense, the intel, the law enforcement, and the courts are frighteningly, if not completely controlled by the left, dangerously close to being controlled by the left, lock, stock, and barrel. And, you know, you talk about, you know, the assassination attempts on potentially on Trump. All you have to do is look at what Biden is doing to RFK Jr. by denying him Secret Service protection. That will clue you into a whole bunch of things and underscore the points that you're making vis-a-vis the dangers between November and January should Trump actually pull out a W.
You know, I think you're both more right than I am. I focused on what the Democrats might do, but I think you're both 100% right that it's not in their interest to secede. As CBD said, they want to conquer. And JJ, you said it too. So talk about the Republicans seceding then. Go ahead. Talk about that.
Well, you know, I think the noise coming out of Texas and a little bit in Florida and maybe some of, you know, Eastern Idaho and places like that, I think is driven primarily by the overreach of the federal government. But that, you know, there's nothing new about that. The interesting thing about Texas is that it would, in one fell swoop, be a significant player on the world stage simply because of the amount of petroleum and natural gas that it controls. They have a significant manufacturing base. They have a significant technological base. Austin is an amazing technology town. It's a shithole in other ways, but it's, you know, technologically it's quite advanced. Texas has beef cattle. Texas has dairy. Texas has other agriculture. Texas is pretty much set. Florida, less so technologically, but it would certainly be a major player on the world stage, and joined together a resurgent South. Let's say Florida, Alabama, out to Texas. Would be a very, very interesting thing. And it would be very, very difficult for a fractured blue state consortium, let's say. It wouldn't even be a country to fight that sort of thing. These are pipe dreams. Everybody understands that. I am not suggesting it. I'm not 100% sure that it would be a good thing, but it is certainly logically consistent.
Yeah, let me interject here for one second, CBD, to your point about this potential sort of realignment, if you will, with Texas and all the goodies that it has vis-a-vis its natural resources and its abundance of wealth and so on and so forth. We already know that there's a war brewing and a war going on right now, really, in the administrative state and the courts between Abbott, Governor Abbott, and with the Biden junta vis-a-vis the illegal alien invasion from south of the border. And so far, Abbott has resisted as best he can and has won a minor victory, I think, at the court level in being allowed to deport and capture and arrest and detain the illegal aliens that are invading. But let's say going on into the future, the Biden junta already has, you know, put a ban on the exportation of LNG, liquid natural gas. So what happens? Does Abbott just say, screw the EPA, screw the federal government, I'm selling my natural gas anyway? So now you set up a situation where there's another line of a constitutional crisis and a potential flashpoint for, civil war.
Let me speak now on this, because you know you're both confirming, in a sense, my pessimism about should any secession take place. Because here we are, the conservative half, the Republican side, talking about not trying to save the country, but breaking the country up. In other words, we're not willing. We're actually willing to discuss the possibility of, rather than fight them anymore, walk away from them. And that means we're not willing, as a right, to defend what I pointed out as this great noble experiment of government by, of, and for the people. And in 1860, the North was willing to fight and die in great numbers, more than any other war possibly ever, considering population and numbers killed, to defend the great American experiment. And what I sense from the right and from the left is an unwillingness anymore to do that. And that is what I find most tragic. You know, I'm probably the oldest one in this group. And I grew up in the 50s and 60s. And I remember the America of the post-World War II era, personally remember it. And the sense of those Americans then, that for World War II, that you fight for freedom and you are willing to die for freedom. And unfortunately, and Kennedy, remember, Democrats said, I stand for freedom. I've written about that in great bill in Genesis, Apollo 8, about the Apollo 8 mission to the moon, because it was based, that whole space race was based on the same great American experiment of liberty and the pursuit of happiness must be defended. And I am sadly getting a sense from all sides that people don't want to defend it.
But here's the thing, Bob. Right, here's the thing. One side does not want the American experiment to succeed. They want to kill it. And our side, unfortunately, if we want, there is no alternative. There is no two-state solution. And there has to be a one-state solution. It has to be either us or them. Because let's face it, the Democrat left, for all intents and purposes, is an alien culture, and they are within our borders right now. And the only way to save the United States, and I don't want to go down a very dark path here, but the only way to do that is to conquer them and to denazify every blue state, every blue city, every blue county, and every blue mind that we possibly can, and to never let them rise again. How you do that and preserve, let's say, the First Amendment, I don't know. But that's unfortunately the situation that we face. I would rather we did not have to face that. I would rather we had some kind of common ground, but I don't see we have a common ground anymore. And you're right. Like we did back then, what we should have done was to ban and abolish the Democrat Party and literally occupy the South for an indefinite period of time. But we didn't have the stomach to do that. And so there, all of a sudden, you had Jim Crow, you had everything else that came with it. And then ultimately, you know, everything that's happened since the end of World War II. So, yeah, I just don't see us coming together, much as I would love to be able to see that.
I think that I will say this, that it could be, it very well could be that Joe Biden is bringing everyone together, but not on his side. He's, like I say, he's so bad that he might actually be creating a cascade effect that might not be reflected in the polls, but might be to such an extent that even many Democrats, and you see it in the polls among the Black and Hispanic communities, these numbers are historic, the shift. And they are shockingly historic in the Black community, especially. And that indicates a major change that could bring us together in the end. It's a hope. I am an optimist. I'm always trying to be an optimist. So I wrote this three-part series with great difficulty because I had to talk about what possibly could go wrong, and we have to be aware of it to go forward. But I am going to write additional essays linking to this, talking about what where the hope is, where things are positive, and that's what I hope for. I mean, I'm a space guy. What do I like to write about most? I like to write about the exploration of the unknown, which is science, which is space exploration. I was a caver for 40 years. I've actually gone where nobody has ever gone before. I must have surveyed close to 3 miles of Virgin Passage, you know, a place that no one's ever been before, and we were on a team survey. And so I'm very much into exploring the unknown. That's what I'm into. And so I want to be optimistic and hope that that can continue.
Well, I think your optimism is, I'm not going to say misguided, but I think you're being optimistic.
Well, remember the three part essay I wrote was anything but optimistic.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Once again,
my point is that When you look at the great unwashed of the Democrats, these are by and large poorly educated, jingoistic drones who are very, very willing to be led. They are very desirous of being in a collective, and being in a large group, being in a crowd, being part of something larger than themselves. And I don't want to say the great unwashed, but the other side of that, those on the right in the United States, those who are more conservative, tend to be far, far more individualistic. They are believers in American exceptionalism, which honors the individual, which honors that person as being paramount. And unfortunately, with that attitude comes a startling degree of disinterest in what is going on around them. And you see in our history that we simply did not respond quickly enough to many, many challenges. The Civil War is a great example. We dithered for 25 years, and we finally had to fight a war. We dithered for a couple of years probably 5 or 6 years in the run-up to World War II, and we lost many, many hundreds of thousands of men because of it. We could have made a difference earlier, but we did not. The sleeping giant is not a little joke about the United States. We have to be challenged beyond belief before we act in concert. And the left acts in concert at the drop of a hat. And that is the difference.
This once again brings it back to where Biden might finally be. Help unify the country. I'm looking for silver lining in what I see is generally a cloud. And that's so I look for those silver linings. I can't help it because it's the only way I can survive. But in doing so, one has to go down the rabbit hole of all the negatives to try to get a real sense of what is going to happen. And therefore, when you fight a war, you have to know your enemy, and you have to know what the enemy trying to do so you can respond properly. And so if we're going to save the country and save this great noble experiment of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we better damn well understand what the Democrats and the left is doing and trying to do. I have been endlessly frustrated for more than 3 decades at the inability to get ordinary people to even listen to some of the horrors going on within the Democratic Party. Let me tell a story of my last trip to Israel, because it bears on what JJ said about Americans not needing a lot to get started to fight back. We visited someone who, a 70-year-old man who grew up in Germany. I take that back. He didn't grow up in Germany, but he knew someone who from Germany who survived the concentration camps. And what she would tell him in the 50s about the period in Germany when the Nazis were in power, she told him the most horrifying thing was not the concentration camps, was not the genocide, was not the oppression by the Nazis. To her, the most horrifying thing was the inability of her to get an ordinary, decent Germans to recognize and believe that was going on, that the Nazis were evil, were doing bad things. And my experience in the last 30 years in discussing with Jewish liberal liberal Jews, secular and religious, is an incomplete inability to get them to believe some of the real things that are going on within the very corrupt Democratic Party. And it's that unwillingness to believe that is put us in this boat right now. You know, the old saying, for evil to triumph, good men need only do nothing. And that's what people have been doing for 30, 40 years. And we are now faced with a situation where this very bigoted leftist Marxist cohort controls entertainment, corporations, academia, the political world, the administrative state. They control them all. And the media, they control the media. And we are fighting a endless retreat because we haven't been pushing back for so many years. And so JJ's point is very well taken, that the right tends to be individualistic and they don't team up very often. But the tragedy in the United States right now is that unwillingness to do anything for so long puts us in such a deep hole. I don't know how we can get out. And like I said, I try to keep looking for things, but I don't find them.
No, I actually agree with you. The you know, Israel is a perfect example, because the unwillingness of many Israelis to admit the savagery and the inhumanity of Hamas and the other Islamic organizations is unbelievable. You know, a large number of the people who were massacred along the Gaza border on October 7th were exactly the people who felt that Gaza is Singapore on the Mediterranean, just it needs a little bit of a push, and the Palestinians are our compatriots, and everything is going to be wonderful if we just be nice. Well, guess what happened? Israel was nice. They didn't admit the problem, and they were massacred because of it. Now, in Israel, the unity is unbelievable. This has been a sea change in Israel. Whether their political masters appreciate that and stay the course is another question.
Let me interrupt.
Go ahead.
I have many relatives who live in Israel, and I talk to them. Some of those relatives, even though very religious, also have been very liberal for most of their life. But I get a sense there is total unity within and inside the government and within the whole country. There is very few people who are not totally in favor of wiping Hamas out. Israel has very, I wrote an essay called Israel's Pearl Harbor. That's what October 7th was for them. They are not backing down. And they don't care what Joe Biden says. And I was told them pretty much in those words, we don't care what you say. We don't care if you threaten to take our support away. We're proceeding and we're going to finish the job. They are very much unified in this sense. And that's good. But think of what it took for them to get
that,
a lot of
exactly. That's ex- and yeah, it, that. And you're exactly right.
And what's even more horrifying is the number, and most Americans are on Israel's side here, but it's still disturbing the number of Americans who are willing to immediately accept Hamas's lies about genocide, Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. They are not willing to even now believe that Hamas is the terrorist organization it is. They said after October 7th, they were interviewed saying, our goal is to wipe out all the Jews in the world, millions of people. Our goal is to do that. They admitted that after October 7th. And yet you still have people in the United States, especially, who aren't willing to face those facts. They don't want to believe, like the woman experienced in Nazi Germany. And when you're in that situation, genocide can occur, a real genocide, because the bad guys are not being challenged. And
well, this is why I tell all of my Jewish compatriots to buy guns, buy ammunition, learn how to shoot, carry if you can, and be aware that it can happen anywhere. Israel was the last great hope of the Jewish people, and by and large, it has satisfied those hopes. It has certainly rewarded us with an incredible, incredible country. But they are one Iranian nuclear weapon away from massive destruction. And
which might actually occur now because of that embassy.
Yes, because of the kindness of the Obama junta through their proxies in Washington right now. the idea that we are still giving to Iran, and not, you know, it's one thing for Iran to foment mass murder against the Jews in Israel. Okay, that's what they do, but they're also killing Americans, and the Biden Obama junta doesn't seem to care very much, which fascinates me.
Yeah, they don't care a whit at all. And what's really, you know, so far, I mean, the Israeli government, just on a tactical or a granular level here on the issue, they've held very, very, very close. They've unified around this notion of we got to wipe out Hamas no matter what. But supposedly Benny Gantz is supposedly wavering and, you know, talking to Blinken and this one and that one. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think they're going to have to go in and wipe out the last remaining, I think it's four units or four divisions or battalions of Hamas.
Yeah, they call them battalions.
Whatever it is. If you can wipe them out, so much the better, and that will be that. As far as Iran goes, I mean, and the threats to, like, withhold arms and ammunition from Israel, and what's so perverse about it is it's all because Joe Biden is afraid of losing, you know, Minneapolis and Dearborn and Michigan and perhaps parts of Wisconsin, my own home state, to the Muslim Americans, instead of standing by, you know, it's so perverse and so horrible and just disgusting. On top of that, let's face it, the Democrats hate the Jews, at least the modern day Democrats, at least of the last 15, 20 years or so. So we'll see what happens. And as far as Iran with nuclear weapons and weapons in general, I think behind the scenes, and maybe not even behind the scenes, the Saudis and the Emiratis and Bahrain are probably going to be giving Israel as much ammunition as they can to help them wipe out Hamas and to defend against a potential Iranian attack, because there is also the Shiite Sunni split that nobody seems to want to address. So that might be
addressed. We could take tremendous advantage, and yet we do nothing. It's unbelievable. Listen, folks, we're running up on a hard stop. So I want to move on to Robert's real area of expertise, which is the space program. But before that, I want you to go to behindtheblack.com and read his 3-part piece. It's very well laid out. He explains what he thinks is going on. And, you know, we've had some disagreements on this podcast, but he pretty much nails it. So once again, behindtheblack.com. So I want to move on to space.
Dan, let me interrupt just a second. If people go to the website and they want to read that 3-part essay, either in the right column or at the bottom of the page, depending on what device you use, you'll see a statement, the 10 most recent essays and commentaries, and you'll see links to all 3 parts there, because it's not on the front page anymore. It's moved away.
Perfect. So on to Bob's area of expertise and his, you know, his passion, which is the exploration of space and science and all the things that are completely the opposite of what we're the left and Hamas is doing to us. It is the height of human aspiration and all the good things.
Just to insert, we can find out exactly where the left is and the Democratic Party by their response to Elon Musk and SpaceX.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's perfect.
Any politician in the past, if he was in Brownsville, Texas, would have demanded a photo op with Elon Musk at Starbase, at the Boca Chica site with Starship. But Joe Biden went to Brownsville and it had nothing to do with him. And there he has used the administrative state as much as he can to squelch SpaceX's attempts to do things. And what SpaceX represents is an old-fashioned American company, very high standards, very good engineering, very high quality work, and pushing the envelope of what can be done. That's an American company in every way. And that the Democrats are hostile to it and are doing everything they can, either with their activist groups, with their administrative state, to stymie or squelch SpaceX, tells you everything you need to know about them. And it's a tragedy, but it tells you where they stand. They are not for great achievement. They are for squelching it everywhere they can. Now, let me talk quickly. This is a good, you know, talking about space, I want to talk about my most recent book called Conscious Choice, The Origins of Slavery in America and Why It Matters Today and for Our Future in Outer Space. Conscious Choice, I started writing this book about the origins of slavery in the 1600s in the United States, because I, as a historian, I knew British culture, and I knew British culture at that time in the 1500s and 1600s was totally opposed to the concept of slavery. There were some British sailors, captains, who tried to trade slaves, but they could not sell them in England. No one wanted them. This was a nation totally culturally hostile to slavery. And the question I asked is, well, why did they end up as slaves? How did slavery start then in Virginia, in the Southern colonies? How could that happen? And I asked that question in the context of being interested in space, because for the rest of human history, one of our biggest problems that's going to always come up over and over again is establishing new colonies on new worlds. This is going to be an endless problem. And what the British experienced in North America in the 1600s and 1700s gives us a wonderful framework, a set of experiments on what will work and what will not. And so I wrote the book, I dug into the original sources to try to find out how it happened that over a period of 100 plus years, Virginians went from hostile to slavery to having half their population as slaves controlled by them. So I wrote that book with the thought of how that would give us information for establishing colonies in the future to avoid that mistake. But it also has direct impact on today, because the mistakes the Virginians made are very similar to the kind of mistakes Americans have been making for the last 50 years. And the similarity is instructive. You know, history doesn't repeat, it rhymes, as Mark Twain said. But nonetheless, because similar things can produce similar results, looking at the past can teach you what to do in the future. So that's why I wrote this book. And though it's mostly about past history as a historian, it teaches lessons for the future. And I want to just add one more thing about conscious choice, which is that I forgot what I was going to say.
It's all right.
Yeah, welcome to the blog. That's what we do all the time.
Well, you could segue into breasts, or we talked about the Civil War, which we always do on the blog. Yeah.
But I want to get back to SpaceX. I find it fascinating that Elon Musk has had essentially a perfect record of developing fantastic heavy lift vehicles, and the way he does it by just trying shit. Oh, look, that didn't work. Well, let's try something else. And he just keeps plugging away, and he hires good engineers, and they're building good rockets, and it's just going to get better. And I find that fantastic. I don't give a rat's ass about his cars. I think Teslas are toys. They're, you know, they're golf carts that go fast. I think his contribution to society is the space space program.
Well, first, I hate the word program. We don't want a space program, because that implies the government's running it from on top.
Oh,
and that's what we had.
Excellent point. I apologize.
I always say what I want is a chaotic space industry of many different people following their dreams. What makes Elon Musk so good is he always recognizes that he can be wrong. He is no certainty. He once did an interview with Tim Dodd from Everyday Astronaut. You might have heard of him. Tim Dodd's a very good space geek. And in that interview, Elon Musk said, "You," and I'm quoting pretty precisely here, "you would be insane if you didn't listen to someone who was telling you you're doing something wrong." And that's how he functions. That's the kind of engineers he wants. If you raise a question, he's going to address the question. He's not going to just put you off. And that has been the problem of the big space government-run businesses in our space program for 50 years. They don't like to be told you're wrong. They hide from it. They push away from it. It's got to be their way or the highway. And that's not how Musk thinks. And that's why he succeeds. And I agree with you about Tesla. But nonetheless, he's built probably the best electric car that's been made.
Yes.
That doesn't mean it's a smart choice, but it's still the best electric car that's been made. If you're going to buy one, stupid decision maybe, but if you're going to buy one, I would say go with a Tesla. And that's, once again, Musk. in general, the space.
I was going to say, you know, Bob, just real briefly, it's amazing that, you know, and of course, things will circle back to politics. But the only reason really the government is going after Musk is perhaps part of it is this jealousy that he's doing things that bureaucracies can't. But because he bought Twitter and he kept it alive as a relatively one of the few remaining mass public media sources that are open to conservative voices of dissent, that's really why they're trying to crush him and crush Twitter. But as an aside, when I post your a lot of your links over the last couple of years, however many we've been doing it, you always include this little blurb about this represents the 30th launch and you do a tally about how many launches Musk has done, and as opposed to how many launches that, if there are any other private companies, but certainly other governments, and he's always in the lead. And America, because of him, is always in the lead in launches in space. And it's amazing. And you want to talk about doing something and getting it right and listening to people. Look at, compare and contrast Elon Musk and SpaceX to, unfortunately and sadly and tragically, Boeing, and what's going on with them with all the failures and the you know, because they've embraced the DEI nonsense in constructing airplanes. And it's such a tragedy, and it's so completely unavoidable. And we're valuing skin color and sexual orientation over experience and know-how and knowledge. And it's just, what a tragedy. And it just doesn't have to be that way.
The American space industry for 50 years was captured by the federal government. So most of the big space companies like Boeing, like Lockheed Martin, like Northrop Grumman, they lost interest in being competitive or innovative. They were at the government dole, and they were going to just do what the government told them to do. And so nothing got done for 50 years. And what's changed now is that Musk has challenged everybody. And what's interesting is that these big space companies like Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin are struggling to survive in a new world where there are many other companies like SpaceX coming along. No one yet matches SpaceX, no one, but several are laying the groundwork to be major competitors with them. Let me talk about Jeff Bezos and his company Blue Origin, founded almost the same time as SpaceX in the early 2000s. Companies are both about a quarter century old, but Blue Origin, run by Jeff Bezos, has been so far a disappointment, and that's an understatement. And it's partly because Jeff Bezos, he's a leftist, and he therefore was willing, he wants to be a government funded operation. He doesn't want to compete on the open market for a very long time. And it's possible that's finally changing at Blue Origin, and I pray it does, because we need other companies competing with SpaceX. I don't want SpaceX to dominate the industry. I want us to have the American chaotic industry we had in the airline business. You used to have Douglas, Boeing, McDonald, Lockheed, Martin Marietta, and Martin, these all were different companies. They consolidated into one or two companies and therefore stopped being creative. What we want instead is dozens of rocket companies doing dozens of different things creatively and in competition with each other, and also pushing what they particularly want to do rather than what they're being told to do by the federal government. And so Musk and SpaceX is a good example of that. They don't do what the government tells them to do. They do what they want to do and then sell the product to the federal government. And the result is the federal government NASA is getting really good bang for its buck, but it doesn't own it. SpaceX owns it, and SpaceX is using it to sell to others. And for that reason, even though NASA is funding right now three different space station constructions, they're all private, and they all have other funding involved, and they're all going to be selling their stations, the use of their stations, to private individuals and companies, as well as NASA. The company that's building a space station that likely will launch first is a private company that's taking no federal dollars, no money from NASA. It's called VAST, and they're building a large station with individual modules, and the first module is going to go up on a spaceship, on a SpaceX rocket, likely Starship. And they are actually likely to be the first to have a space station independent in orbit with no government money. And that's how it should be. We should not be dependent on the government to do any of this kind of stuff.
You know, it's fascinating that the government is actually actively malignant when it comes to SpaceX. They're going after them all the time for trivialities. You know, some little water rat was killed by one of their launches, so they want to shut down the entire his entire spaceport. You know, crap like that.
CBD, what's interesting is there are people in the federal government that would like SpaceX to succeed that are in the bureaucracy that SpaceX has to deal with. But they are, of course, controlled by the White House and the Biden administration. They have to follow orders. And it's the orders coming from the top that has definitely been trying to slow SpaceX down. The thing is that SpaceX is following Elon Musk's dream. Every company he's developed, the Boring Company to build tunnels, Tesla to build electric cars, SpaceX to build rockets, Starlink to provide internet communication to the world. Every one of those innovative technologies comes from Musk's desire to colonize Mars, because you're going to need good electric cars. You're going to need a communication system, a global communication system. You're going to need cheap rockets. You're going to need to be able to bore holes in the ground to maybe build your settlements. And so every company he's created has been with colonization in mind. He's following his dreams. And if that isn't the American dream, I don't know what is. And we should be applauding him at all times, all times. Even if you disagree with him, so what? He's an American. He has the right to say what he wants to say. And if you disagree with him, it's just you state your disagreement, and that's fine.
You know, if you disagree with Elon Musk, you're actually a racist, because Elon Musk is technically an African American. So I mean, there you go. And by the way, our mission is not to colonize; we have to decolonize. That's the watchwords. Oh boy, the irony is with all of this crap is just amazing. But you know, Bob, you're talking about all these companies and how the government is just sabotaging things and they're in bed with them. But when you go back to World War II, you look at companies like Lockheed, North American Aviation, Martin, which was the Glenn Martin Company, so on and so forth, Consolidated Aircraft, Vulti. You know, they didn't want to just take, you know, yes, they profited off of the war and they made a lot of money, but they were interested in producing aircraft and tanks and weapons that would not only kill and bomb and destroy our enemies, but that American pilots and tank commanders and boat captains would be safe, as safe as they possibly could, and bring them home alive. And today it's like, what a travesty and what a shame that's how we've devolved into.
I'm going to insert a plug, but also it's going to give you some hope. In 2017, I wrote a policy paper for a think tank in DC that tries to bring Republicans, Democrats together. So it's basically middle of the road, blah, blah. But they asked me to do a policy paper on what the government should do in the future. And so I wrote a policy paper. It's a free download on Behind the Black. It's called Capitalism in Space, in which I argue the problem we've had in the space program since the 1960s is that the government is no longer the customer. The government is the builder, the designer, the builder, the owner of everything that gets built. They built the space shuttle. They used private enterprise to get it built, but it belonged to NASA. And so therefore, NASA wasn't interested in making profit or selling the product to others. In fact, there are several major companies offered to give NASA more than $1 billion to build a fifth shuttle in the 1970s for private use only, and NASA turned it down. So what my policy paper says is that the government should stop being the builder, designer, owner of things. It should go back to the old way of doing things in World War II and in the 20s and the 30s and most of our history, which is the government is a customer. It buys the product from the private sector. It doesn't own the product. The owners of the product, the private companies, can sell that product to other people. And SpaceX is a great example, but they're not the only one, where they own their capsules, their Dragon capsules, and their rocket. And after they launch NASA astronauts, which is their main customer, they sell tickets and seats on their Dragon capsules and rockets to others. A private guy, Jared Eisenman's flown twice, and he's going to do three more flights, one on Starship, but he's totally private. He's independent from the government. And so that's the key thing. And my policy paper in 2017, I know it was distributed throughout DC in the Trump administration. And I know that that policy paper was what instigated the major transition shift in the Trump administration from building an old-fashioned Kennedy-like, we're going to go to the moon by this date and the government's going to do it. Trump administration switched and went to what they call a public-private partnership, whereby the government hires private companies to get things done. So now we no longer have a government capsule take off shuttle bringing people up and down to ISS. We have, hopefully very soon, two different private companies, SpaceX and Boeing, bringing people up and down using capsules. And we have other companies, Sierra Space, building a mini shuttle for bringing cargo up and down, and eventually maybe people. And so we've got multiple companies. They own what they do, and they build what they do. So NASA has actually moved in the right direction. It just has to work around the problems that come from the government and the Biden administration.
So that, in a nutshell, is you're looking for free market solutions to a technological problem.
Yeah, exactly right.
It's simple. It's quite simple. That's called American exceptionalism.
I like to bring up what I call the forgotten word. American exceptionalism, but it's all true. But the word I like to use is freedom. It's a forgotten word we don't use.
Yeah, we don't use that very often.
I use it all the time. We should be encouraging freedom. Let free Americans follow their dreams and produce good things when they do so. When you allow freedom, and this is what happened with the shift at NASA from being the owner to the customer. They opened up the market freely to everyone to compete, to provide products to NASA and to everybody else. I'll give you an example. The NASA this week awarded developmental contracts to three different American companies, consortiums, actually. They're all partnerships, to build a manned rovers for exploring the moon. They're allowing three different companies to develop the product. NASA's giving development money to all three. All three will have to put up some of their own cash to do the development because they're going to own it down the road. But in the end, what we're going to have is multiple rovers that can be sold not just to NASA, but to anyone else who wants to explore the moon. And that's how it should work. That's how freedom functions. You allow as many people the right to do things as they wish to. Pursuit of happiness, to quote Thomas Jefferson.
That works for me. Anyway, folks, we are running long, so we're going to sign off now. But thank you, Robert Zimmerman. Thank you very, very much. It has been a pleasure. Robert Zimmerman of BehindTheBlack.com. Go there, read his three-part essay on what's going to happen in November.
More important, go there and look at all those cool pictures I post. From
yeah, there. I'm looking at it right now. There's a pretty cool picture on his splash page. It's great.
Exactly. Listen, gentlemen, Bob, it has been an absolute pleasure to finally get a chance to speak with you on the podcast. And to everybody, just to, again, on a point of personal privilege, I can't begin to express my gratitude and joy at the wonderful notes of prayer and messages to me, personal messages, as I go through this medical situation with my head. take a little off the top, please, and natural back and sides, Mr. Neurosurgeon. But anyway, so far things are looking good. Just to give you a little bit of an update, and if there are any more updates, and hopefully I'll be back next week, please God, with CBD for another episode. So for CBD and Robert Zimmerman, it's JJ Sefton here. Thanks for listening, and we will see you again on the next one.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening, folks.